On House Water and Environment.
Mr. Sheriff.
Captain Cruz.
I make the rule to be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on Senate Bill 156.
Captain Cruz. Move the rule to suspend for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on Senate Bill 156. Any objections? None. So moved.
Mr. Chair.
I move. No, go ahead.
You need to down the bottle.
Yeah.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I move to reconsider the vote by which Senate Bill 156 was sent to the floor with a due cost recommendation.
Mr. Cruz, this is new. Reconsider the vote by which Senate Bill 156 was sent to the floor to pass. Any discussion? We have conflict amendments here. Any objection? No. Motion carries.
Mr. Chair, I move the adoption of the Bashmore Amendment to Senate Bill 156.
Mr. Cruz moves the Bashmore Amendment to Senate Bill 156. I think everybody has a copy of those. So we can discuss that. I don't think we brought in those to the council or anything else. Harrison, was there anything that she wanted to note on that?
Any more isn't.
Okay. Here, I'm not sure I'm queued in on the right. We did make a new section there, didn't we? So, Hunt Law, sections 1 to 6, 1996. Okay.
Okay, I'm going to let Carol come up and talk about the conflict amendments.
Mr. Chair, members, the bill, Senate Bill 156, conflicts with Senate Bill, is it 1049? And what this...
It becomes law.
Right, so if Senate Bill 1049 becomes law, the parts of Senate Bill 156 that I amended are repealed. My understanding is the Board of Accounts, this is another Board of Accountancy bill that it conflicts with, so they know about it.
Yeah. Okay. Any questions? Okay. Hearing none, the clerk please call the roll.
Aye.
Aye.
Hi. Dash one amendment to Senate Bill 156. So moved.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, thank you.
I move Senate Bill 156 back in line with the Chair to this House recommendation.
Mr. Cruz moves Senate Bill 156 back in line to report to this House recommendation. Further discussion. Okay, now we'll report to this call of law.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye. Thank you. To close the work session, we open a hearing on Senate Bill 778. Representative Negley.
Mr. Chairman,
we are. The family has some of them left.
But we're about to yell at
them.
Sure, yeah. We should have this whole thing over.
Yeah, we could have. We could have got lopsided, maybe, but I don't know how to even that out. It's pretty hard.
I'm trying to hold down my hands over here. Person and I together can hold it down.
That's been Netherly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You're having entirely too much fun.
I know.
I'm Ken Messler, State Representative from District 48, which is the Coos Bay south of the California border. I'm also co-chair of the Salmon and Stream Enhancement Committee. And Senate Bill 778 was kind of my baby that we carried through the committee. Started out a very complex bill in which we were going to have the director appointed by the governor and have the commission just be a policy commission. After lots of discussions with lots of people from the different stakeholder groups, a lot of communication with the commission, as well as the director and staff, decided to scale it way back from that, that it was just too aggressive, at least this time, and maybe really wasn't what needed to be done after all. What I think became very apparent to me was that the department does have problems. We are concerned. I think all of us are concerned, and we want them to be successful and be productive. One of the biggest problems I see is they lack policy to guide the staff and to guide the commission and to just guide the whole department. What we came up with in 778 was, well, let me back up a little bit. Another problem was that the commission was way too involved in the day-to-day operations of the department. And so we gave some of the administrative duties back to the staff and more so put the commission in a position of appeal board and the policy commission. We're also concerned of how they progress. They need a work plan. They need to have timetables on that work plan. And we, in this bill, instruct them to come back to the interim committee on a quarterly basis, and that our committee will review this department and give a report back in that session. Just this morning, I received the amendment, which will be presented. And I guess if it's all right, I'd like to discuss that to some degree. Again, let me say, I think that hopefully a lot of the problems of the department will be resolved as they develop their policies to manage their staff and the department. This amendment, I don't have a problem with until you get down to the middle of line 7, after activity, and where it goes on to say that nor shall a person provide such information to any person except under subpoena or official investigation. I think it's problematic because what this should be discussing is that they shall not provide information to any person, information that is not available to the general public. My background is serving on two different bank boards, and I understand insider information very well. Even if it is information which is going to be presented to the public, until it is made available to the public, it's insider information. And I think that's the situation that we have that we're confronted with here. So that would be my only recommendation at this time to the amendment. And I just had a note passed here where they are crossing out all the language after activity on line 7.
Period.
Maybe Mr. Harder should be up here to explain that.
Sure. No, not wrong.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Rod Harder, Executive Director of Oregon Sportsman's Defense Fund. By way, and I would appreciate being able to testify on 778, we very much support this concept and this approach. We have worked and testified at the hearings on this bill, and I think it's come out with a very good product. There's no question in my mind that this agency needs continued oversight, and based on the performance of the last couple of years, I don't think that anyone can question that, and I think this is a good approach to give the legislature a constant handle on what's going on. As regards the amendment, for those on the committee that don't know, there has been recently what can only be described in my mind as a scandal at Fish and Wildlife. 15 of their 15 of the members of the agency were involved in using inside information to gain preference points for controlled hunts. That in itself is exceptionally objectionable. When you read a report that was done by the agency, and I will enter this into the record, and many of you have it, we find that not only was there misuse of information, there was a, in my mind, what if this were to be a criminal act, a conspiracy among very senior members of the staff. It involved the core group that is in charge of controlled hunts. And that is very disappointing to us. This is a program that has always garnered suspicion from the hunting public. And this breach of trust has done nothing except magnify that. They were outraged to start with. When the internal investigation was over and the penalty phase was entered, they became even more outraged with the lack of spine on the part of the agency director to take appropriate actions. In any segment of the business community, people who did this, and I have a member who is a member of the stock exchange. In a moment, I'll read a letter that he wrote.
Mr. Chair, I would like to object to the characterization of state employee in terms that you've just given. I think it's inappropriate to use that language.
Well, I'm referring to the lack of spine comment.
Yeah, but I think you said agents.
So the director of
the director. Okay.
Mr. Chair, Representative Merkley, I apologize.
I try to refrain from that. Addressing to making it personal here, and we'll talk to the attorney if we can, what did develop.
I apologize to the director. I'm searching for a better word, can't seem to come up with one, on the part of the commission and the agency. In any other segment of our business community, those people would be on the street looking for a job. And I feel it was very inappropriate to take the very limited action that was taken and not make it, because it was an insult to the customer. It was an insult to me, it was an insult to the members that I represent. And the attitude hasn't changed. I had another email that I just received last night between one of my members, who is that member of the stock exchange, and George Buckner. And he described his outrage with the lack of appropriate action that was taken by the agency and said that what I have just said, that anyone involved in stock exchange would be out on the street. And Mr. Buckner's reply, if I may read it, "Thanks for your input. I can see your point but question your analogy. From what little I know about the securities business, insider trading is far more than an ethics violation. It's illegal, right? What our employees did was not illegal and did not violate ethics as defined by the Ethics Commission. They did, however, violate ethics as defined by our agency. The actions taken are considered by the agency to be commensurate with this level of ethics violation. I'm sorry our actions did not meet your expectations, but I can assure you we do take these actions seriously. Director Greer convened an outside committee to examine the control hunt system to ensure it is fair to everyone." The amendment that I have requested and is before you does one thing. It takes the inability of the agency to take appropriate action, and it gives them the method to do that. It states from this confidential report the problem, and it creates a misdemeanor penalty in accordance with the wildlife law. The district attorney that did this case could not prosecute because it was not a crime. He expressed his outrage in a letter which I have made available to this committee previously. The state police could not carry on with the investigation because there was no crime involved. And it appears when the investigation was done internally by Fish and Wildlife that there was nothing that they had to hang their hat on to take forceful and appropriate action. That's the reason I bring this amendment before you. I just got it 5 minutes before the hearing started, and we would recommend that a period be placed after activity and the remainder of the bold face removed, because as has been explained to me, that language would prohibit the agency from even appearing before you and giving testimony on that kind of information. I would be happy to answer any questions, and I would again apologize to the director However, it does not change my feeling about the subject. I am very, probably, this is a very passionate subject with me and with my members, and they are outraged.
Well, I think it is similar to an agency of where our treasury office, and there was something there that is special information to be able to take from the people of the state. And I think that you feel like there was a thief amongst us, and I think that that's what has occurred here. But we have to also look at it's also our fault that very possibly in statute many times until it's a problem we don't realize there was whether we're civil or criminal. Penalties or statutes that apply to something like this. So it's, when you find out there wasn't something like that and there aren't any specific consequences because of individuals within a department and their actions, then, I agree with you. I feel absolutely the same way. And it is, I think, our duty then to correct those things, and that's what I think and hope that we can do here. And we will talk to the department to bring them up here too, and talk to them a little bit about what they felt was appropriate as far as a penalty in the absence of penalties or a policy that directed them when something like this occurred. Yes, President Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Gentlemen, I didn't have the same reaction as you. I was relieved when I read the paper within a few days and found that the director was himself very disconcerted about the actions of the employees and was taking the action that he did take. Is my understanding that the only thing that would make you happy is if he fired 15 people and we charged them with misdemeanors? What is it?
Move the
Class A misdemeanor.
Mr. Chair, Representative Taylor, no, I did not suggest that we fire 15 people. However, when we have upper-level management involved and advised by staff early on in the investigation that something bad was going on and that information was ignored, and I think those people in upper level management should be held to a higher level and should meet a higher standard than the people out in the field who were unknowing participants. And no, I don't suggest that we fire 15 people at all, but I do suggest that people in positions of trust, people who are in positions of trust, have to perform to a higher standard.
I agree. Mr. Chair, I want to ask one more question, if I may. I think that this should apply not only to the State Department of Fish and Wildlife, but to any public employee who gains information in the course of their official position. I mean, actually, the example that comes to mind for me is the city manager who owns a sand pit and sells that to the public project that's going on or whatever, and anticipates, I mean, those kinds of things that I see in the world happening pretty regularly. And so I don't know why we're limiting this just to the department.
Mr. Chair, Representative Taylor, I didn't have a vehicle to get the rest of it done. This is a vehicle that addresses the department, and believe me, if I had a method of doing it, I would certainly support that.
Mr. Chair, if I might respond. I think there's really two issues here. The first issue is the breach of the information and the trust. The second issue is the time frame in which this all happened. As I understand, the director of the Wildlife Division was made aware of this in October, responded in November. The director of the Fish and Wildlife Department, Mr. Greer, was not notified of this by anyone until March. I think that's a tremendous breakdown of protocol information. It would seem to me that it would have been appropriate for the director of the Wildlife Division to make a phone call within 5 minutes of when he got notified. And so I think there's an issue of trust and responsibility there too.
We're going to stand at ease here. There are three of us who would like to go vote. We're on the revenue committee, so we'll just stand at ease. We'll be back shortly. Hang on.
Thank you very much.
We'll be done with it. We are released the at ease and are once again open to a hearing on Senate Bill 717. Let's see. I didn't mean to run everybody else out on their testimony if they had further testimony, but we'll go ahead and bring Jim Greer up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Jim Greer, Director of Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. Let me just speak to the bill that we're discussing this morning, Senate Bill 778, in terms of some of the issues that Representative Miserly spoke to. We would concur that there's still a tremendous amount of work that needs to be done within the agency, and I think we have a lot of policies that could be beefed up or actually created, I think, to get to some of these accountability issues. I've given Representative Miserly a draft accountability plan that we would be putting in place over the next 18 months between now and the next session. And I agree that I think there are some issues that we could bring forward on a progressive basis before the interim committee that's listed here in the bill to give them an update. I would welcome that opportunity. I think it's good for our agency to come forward and make sure it's clear to the legislature just how we are progressing on some of these critical issues. The intent that we have heard discussed relative to the addition of two commission members was really based on what we saw as a potential need in the future. And I think we worked with Representative Miserly and a lot of the others that we spoke to that if, in fact, we get to the point where the kinds of issues that the commission is dealing with are so complex and cover such broad areas that we would need to assign essentially subcommittees. And we're trying that right now. We have a ground space or a marine program subcommittee of commissioners to address what we consider a very complex issue. We're dealing with harvest allocations of fish and other species in the ocean that are shared by other states and countries through a number of different commissions and boards. So by doing so, I think our commissioners will be more in touch and more familiar with some of these issues before they make critical decisions. So what we saw is an intent of this bill would be when the commission saw a true need to expand their commission numbers, that the bill would allow for the commission to go to the governor and make that request based on your report of some kind that showed a need for additional commission members. So I think this is, again, another tool that would be very positive and proactive relative to the agency's needs. Other than that, I think we would agree with Representative Miserly of the language that we see within Senate Bill 778 and would concur with it as it's currently written. If you'd like me to speak to the proposed amendments, I'd be happy to do that as well. Again, we just received these this morning. And let me say a few things about this controlled hunt controversy that has just unfolded in the last 2 months. I didn't waste any time once we got a report from the District Attorney's Office in Multnomah County, which had done a review with the Oregon State Police of the possible advantage gained by employees by applying to a specific strategy for controlled hunts. I immediately took any kind of preference point advantage away from those employees immediately. I initiated a internal review immediately, and we also identified that there would be a task force to, in any way possible, unfold all other possibilities of employee advantage or other issues relative to the controlled hunt program that needed to be revamped or improved by a task force, of which Mr. Harder, who testified earlier, will be a member of that task force. After our internal review was complete, we found, and I want to make sure that some of the statements said earlier are not considered as they have mischaracterized some of the findings. One employee was found to have done nothing wrong, no misconduct. Three of those employees were found to have applied for this hunt through a strategy that was initiated by another member of their hunting party, and they were really not aware in any way that there was an advantage to them for applying for a canceled hunt. The remaining employees, I handed down disciplinary action ranging from letters of reprimand, letters of warning, which I'm sure some folks may find to be not necessarily strong enough. But I think if you consider the facts and you look at what these employees did, as you go up in terms of the authority of the remaining employees that were involved in this issue, I handed down some fairly strict disciplinary action. Some members were removed from their positions for a week to 2 weeks. This, if you really want to look at the monetary impact, was anywhere from over $3,000 to $1,200, depending on the employee. They were also banned from hunting big game species for this coming season. Now, our agency has never handed down a disciplinary action that removed hunting privileges from any of their employees. And additionally, we took away our points that might have been gained in the prior year. I guess I would ask you to look at what the crime really was and what the punishment is, the punishment of meeting the crime. This information that these employees took advantage of was available to the public. The issue that I found where they did actually misuse that information in terms of our internal policy relative to ethics was the fact that they didn't ask a couple of additional questions. Was that information broad enough for the general public to take advantage of a strategy that might give them an additional preference point into the next year's hunt? And let's be clear that that is the only advantage that the employees would gain, would be a preference point. There is no financial gain here. There is no other gain other than a preference point that might give them a higher level of percentage of drawing the tag in the following year. So what I saw was a disciplinary action that matched the offense. The information was available to the public, but not generally so. And I believe if some of these folks at higher levels within the organization, and I felt that I handed down some fairly strict disciplinary action, had thought a little bit more closely about the decisions they were making, they did not ignore the information provided to them last October, but they looked at it in terms of how widespread that information was available, and made some poor decisions in terms of moving forward with actually applying for these controlled hunts without getting that information out to the general public as a whole. So I would disagree with some of the characterizations and some of the statements made earlier. I believe the task force that we have put in place now, which has members of the hunting public, the president of the Oregon Hunters Association, Rod Harder, Oregon State Police, Eric Purcell, who is the department head of the Oregon Department of Fisheries and Wildlife at Oregon State University, and a number of others will be able to look at any other kinds of issues related to gained advantage by employees or issues related to the control and selling program that need to be improved over the next 6 months. And those recommendations will go to the commission by October or November of this year, and we'll make those alterations so that this control hunt process remains as fair and equitable as it possibly can for everyone in the state. And I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Maybe you could explain to me the controversy. I'm not a hunter, so I'm not sure what the whole point of this is.
Representative Kifori, I'll try to explain. It does get a little technical. What happens is occasionally we display all the hunt proposals in the synopsis every year. It comes out in January, February of every year. It has several hundred hunts identified in the synopsis for a variety of species, deer, elk, antelope, sheep, all those different big game species. In some cases, during the winter months, we'll have a die-off or we'll have impact to certain populations or we'll have damage that's actually been resolved on a private landowner's piece of property where that hunt is no longer necessary. All the hunters have been applying for those hunts since January. The tag sale deadline is May 15th. When our biologists get all their biological information that comes in at the end of the winter around April or so, that's when they make the final determination if all those hunts should go forward to the commission for a final decision on tag numbers. In the instances of 1978, we had four or five, or six, I can't remember exactly, how many hunts were canceled. To no fault of the hunter, then, they no longer have that opportunity to participate in that hunt or actually have their tag or their application in the drawing to get that hunt because we canceled it. So in trying to be equitable and fair to all the hunters, for any hunt that was canceled
we would say that on their application, if their second choice, would become their first choice. Their first choice was the canceled hunt. The second choice down, you can have up to five or six choices, would become their first choice. And even if they drew that tag, they would still get a preference point. And the preference point is simply a point that moves you forward into the next drawing to give you an advantage. And depending on the number of points you've accumulated over time, that will give you a higher percent draw for each successive year. So what we were trying to do for those people that applied for Hunt that weren't aware of the fact that we were going to cancel them that had already applied, the computer would go to their second choice. So what the employees did, and this information was made available to the public, but on a fairly limited scale. What the employees did, as did 1,600 other members of the public that applied for these canceled hunts, there were 1,600 applications. We don't know how many of those publics actually knew of this advantage, or this strategy is what it is. They applied for the canceled hunt as their first choice. So they knew in advance, because of the fact that the hunt had been canceled, that they would automatically have the computer draw their second choice, and whether or not they got that second choice, they'd be granted a preference point.
And that's the advantage. Disagree, was there any of the public that sent letters to the department and stating to you that they did not know about this, or they needed that kind of information too, ahead of time?
Yes, Mr. Chair, we had both letters indicating people that were aware of the strategy and a number of people that also agreed they were not aware of that strategy. We have some hunters that...
So this truly is insider information.
There is absolutely some insider information there that could have been taken advantage of.
That's been nothing.
Well, you said this information was available to the public, but not widely distributed. How was this information regarding the strategy distributed or the council canceled?
Representative Merkel, what we have is a number of people over the years that have experienced a canceled hunt impact to them. We send out letters to anyone that has applied for a canceled hunt in the past and tell them about the differences between applying for that canceled hunt and what will actually occur to them if they are canceled and if their second choice becomes their first. There have been some members of the public that have really focused on that particular aspect that actually tracks our biologists' decisions prior to going to the commission relative to canceled hunts so that they can take advantage of that information. There's some reference in our synopsis relative to canceled hunts. And there's also a group that publishes a book every year, and I can't remember the name of it. Anyway, what they've done is they've scrutinized our whole entire controlled hunt program to look for strategies, and essentially sell that booklet that talks about what's your best opportunity to get a tag based on your percent chance of draw. And they had also identified that the canceled hunt strategy in their dissemination of information. So it was limited, and I think that's what we found and what we probably, what these employees that were found to take advantage of that strategy should have done. In thinking about this, you should have asked themselves, well, if it's such a good strategy, why isn't everybody using it? And if everybody was using it, they admit the fact that then they would probably change the control hunt system. The strategy was put in place to get to the person that unknowingly applied for a hunt that was going to be strictly canceled. And in this case, if everybody had known about the canceled hunt program, we would have seen many, many more applications for that.
Sure.
Okay,
clarification on this. I gather that the hunts are canceled in April, if that information becomes public. But to utilize this strategy, you essentially have to wait and apply after the information about the cancellations has been made public.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, the way this works is our biologists come in late April with all their biological counts for the year, and that's when they'll report to the Wildlife Division staff whether or not a hunt should be canceled. Now, there's a time frame between when that information comes in and the tag sale deadline, which is May 15th. So there's also a very narrow window of opportunity to take advantage of that information. You have between the time that the biologists recommend a canceled hunt, and those hunts are not approved until the commission meets in June. But the information is available as to what a proposed hunt for cancellation is in late April and early May. The tag sale deadline is just 2 weeks after that. We also share that canceled hunt information at our public meetings. I think this last year we held one in almost every district. We have 21 districts currently on the wildlife side. So any information about canceled hunts would have been available at those meetings as well. Does that help you get that?
Well, I'm curious whether there's a structural way to address this problem in the future, such as only getting preference to people who apply early in the season before the information about potential cancellation of hunts. Create some structural fix so that this strategy and the temptation to use this strategy doesn't remain a problem. And whether you're looking into that and if you have proposals on the table.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, that's exactly what the task force is set up to do. And one thing that I did also that I didn't mention earlier is that since there's a very few number of canceled hunts recommended every year, when this information came to my attention, I simply said to the Controlled Hunts Program, we will not have any canceled hunts for 1999. In other words, could we issue just a few tags, less than five, and still have the hunt going forward so there wouldn't be any biological impact, but so that anyone that had applied for that hunt would still have an equal chance of getting those tags. And we can do that. There are some structural ways that we can get at this so that no one would have this advantage in the future.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask, in an effective manner, how this A4 kind of vision might be applied. It was suggested that it would be reduced to just the first sentence of the proposed amendment of Section 6, and means to no employee about that actual further the employee's personal gains for use of information gained in the course of or by leaving a person's official position. This is fairly broad language. I assume you have biologists who find out, for example, where good fishing holes are while they're in the course of employment. How would you, if you are required to, as director, enforce this, how would you enforce this language and how broad do you think it goes?
Sure, and Representative Murphy, I think it is very broad at this stage of the game. I'm not sure how we would employ that. I think we have a couple of things that would have to be defined in what is personal gain relative to the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. Now, some of this language, as I understand it, has come out directly out of our policy that we have in place right now relative to disciplinary action on using information or anything within the department for personal gain. So we have addressed this. This would be the very language or something very similar to this that wouldn't be quite as broad as this that we utilize in terms of disciplinary action used against the employees under the issue at hand. To go any further, which apparently there's a recommendation to strike everything beyond activity, where it says, nor shall a person provide such information, then that would essentially defeat our ability to get any information into the general public relative to information gained by employees while they're on their job. So this would be a very difficult one for us to look at and say, well, just how will we implement this thing so that there is a clear definition or defining point as to where an employee may have gained some information that they could use for their benefit as opposed to what might be a benefit to the general public. I prefer to say something like this, which is what we're proposing to the task force, and run this current question through the task force itself.
That's been true. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Some confusion here. I apply for the hunter's camp. My second choice becomes my first choice, which means I don't have as much of a chance on that second round as anybody else who applies to that. Why do I get a point? Because I haven't really lost anything.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Cruz, the concept behind this was that we impacted your ability to get the hunt of your choice, which was your first choice. We took that away from you because we canceled that hunt. Now, oftentimes, if you look at this in the broader perspective, and you have to be a hunter that is using all these different strategies to figure out how they're going to go hunting, because some of them want to go hunting in the worst way, regardless of the hunt or the tag that they get. So sometimes their second choice might actually be a very non-preferred hunt that there are leftover tags in, because they just want to go hunting. So maybe they apply for the White River Deer Hunt or the White River Elk Hunt, some of these other hunts that are very difficult to hunt. Maybe the percent chance of getting animals is low, and that's why the total number of tags never get distributed in the first drawing. So their second choice is going to be a very unpreferred, in some cases, hunt. Other hunters will use another strategy because they haven't thought this through to any great detail, and they go, well, my first choice, my best place I want to go is choice number one. The second best place I want to go is choice number two. So depending on your strategy, you may or may not get a tag during that second draw or your second choice. And we felt years ago when we put this in place that it would be fair, since we took away your first choice, which is always generally your most preferred hunt, that we would give you that point to go into your next year's point total, so you'd have a better chance of getting your first choice hunt that following year.
How many points do you get if you are not selected?
If you're not selected under this strategy for your second choice?
Your first choice is a hunt that goes forward and you don't draw a tag. How many points do you get?
If you don't draw a tag, you get 1 point annually. And then that goes into your next year's total. And then depending on how many points you get will determine your percent chance of drawing a tag.
So the system as of now is you can accelerate yourself. And of course, most people that apply to tags want to hunt, obviously. But I apply to hunt. The hunt is canceled. I get a point. I send a choice. I don't get a tag. I draw 2 points. Suddenly,
you only get the one. If your hunt is canceled and you didn't get your second choice, you still only get the one, but you get guaranteed a point, even if you drew your tag for your second choice. This is the advantage here. If you drew your second choice tag, then you would still get a point, whereas in the past, if you drew your first choice and you had points, the point total goes to zero and you start over.
Okay.
It's a complicated system.
I guess I still don't see why I get an advantage. I get a hunt and I get all the privileges of not getting a hunt at the same time is basically what we have.
Representative Cruz, I believe it is in the fact that we took that away from you. In the sense that we have just a handful of hunts that get canceled every year, this does not occur very often enough, and happens in cases where we have very few tags associated to that hunt. But if that was your preferred choice, we felt that if we canceled it on you, we would allow you to have your second choice become your first, which is, I believe, a fair issue. And this is where the change comes. Even if you drew that second choice, knowing that it wasn't your priority place to go hunting, we would give you a preference point anyway to go over into the next year's total.
This choice might be separate in a lottery anyway, and I have yet to hear anybody who has disagreed with hunt cancellation because we're dealing with populations here, and nobody wants to see population diminish to the point where we're risking anything here. So as a hunter, I'm not going to be upset if I'm not allowed to hunt here because there's not enough animals there, and I just want to be able to hunt there in the future. So, I have problems with the way this operates. I think based on that, it's also something that as complicated as this system is. It's basically set up whether inside or outside the agency. Anybody with a high level of expertise is going to automatically have an advantage here. And I'm not sure on the front end how you can say that some of your employees who participated in this were unknowingly taking advantage of the situation because they know it's business. So how can you do something and at the same time do it unknowingly? I don't quite understand that part of your testimony.
Representative Cruz, that part of my testimony I think is referring to the three employees. That simply, I'll put it as simply as I can. Some of them were husbands or wives that just went along for the ride. They were not what you consider hardcore hunters. They hunted occasionally. They wanted to be there for the family outing. So what they did was they waited for their spouse to say, well, this is the hunt that we're going to apply for, and they would simply just enter in that hunt number as their first choice.
and essentially they were guilty by association. That's what I said. That's why I said unknowingly. And we did take away their preference points that might have been gained from 1998 from those employees as well.
Mr. Chair.
Sure, hey, Tim. I'd like to get to the body of the bill itself. We have to leave at 9:30.
Right.
And I wondered about Section 5 and 6. I know that since you've come on as director, there has been some reorganization in the agency. And I assume that won't pose any problems to present your present organizational structure to the Joint Legislative Committee that proposed that, and I'm sure you'll have to defend every bit of your operation there. ODF&W seems to be a popular whipping boy every session, and so I've heard other agency heads say they've known worse. But I'm particularly wondering about the rule change that the director can adopt administrative rules according to statute, and this the change seems to be that before a person could petition the Court of Appeals, the commission determines the validity of the rule. I would think that within your process, the commission somehow are involved with the rulemaking. Is that not the case?
Mr. Chair and Representative Taylor, yes, that's true. They are involved in all the rules that we make right now. There are some instances, very few right now, but I think the commission has seen places where they essentially have full agreement on what a very minor rule change would be. What they're trying to get out of, and that's what I think Representative Mesley was referring to in terms of the day-to-day operation, is to hand that rulemaking authority back to the director's position, which was removed back in 1993, I believe. In fact, that's the only rulemaking authority that the director has currently is to do emergency rulemaking, and even that has to have a review by the commission. So what this is trying to get at is to hand some of those more fairly simple or agreed upon, or there's an annual update to a certain plan or something that we already know has fairly good concurrence with the general public as a whole, and let those move forward. And what this is saying is if a member of the public has a problem with that rule being made, they would go directly back to the commission to be sure that there is ample opportunity for public review and opportunity to question maybe the director's action on that rule with the commission themselves. And currently, I don't believe there was a process in place that allowed for that to occur. They would have to go back to the Court of Appeals or some other legal institution. And this just ensures that the commission would be informed of anything that appeared to be very controversial if the director may have approved. So, in what we see this as being an advantage is we can take some of those issues that have now, since 1993, accumulated on the plate of the commission as relatively routine kinds of rulemaking authority, give it to the director, make sure the director has got some public review processes in place, and then have that be made at that time by the director rather than the commission. And I think this is what the Representative Mesley referred to as another tool in the commission's tool bag to help them get out of some of these more detailed operations they're doing right now. Other questions?
Mr. Greer, you said your reaction to what has occurred in the discretion within your management group here and employees adequately move towards reinstating the department's credibility. You think in the eye of those who were involved in ODF&W's program for the most part?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I think that actually this issue can be looked at as a significant wake-up call for the entire agency. I think like any agency, you have a built-in culture over time. We have been downsized. We have been loaded with responsibilities. We're responding to a lot of things outside of what would have been considered 5 to 7 years ago, our normal course of duties and so forth. And I think there has been some lax ways of looking at how we do business within the agency. Frankly, this has probably gotten everybody's attention tenfold. I believe we've already
planning to implement some ethics training for the entire agency. We're going through a customer service training program right now. All of these things are things that I think are because our resources and so forth have been put on the shelf. We've been really focused on the biology over all these many years, and there are some issues that I think that our personnel really need to take a broader view of. I think we're going to see a much better attention to public service after this incident.
Mr. Greer, I noticed that this language does come out of, I think, maybe your policy 2.15. I'm not sure if that must be your policy.
Yes, I haven't had a chance to compare the two, but I believe that's where...
And that's where this language does come from. So if we do exclude the latter part, which I understand, we do have support for that, certainly, for everyone around here, and from you also, on the amendment. The rest of that, though, is it does come right out of your policy of a booklet or whatever you provide here. So, yes, right back and forth.
Can I don't know if Mr. Gray can tell me if you can tell me what by putting this into law as opposed to just having in the policy handbook, what are the implications and what's the consequences of doing this document? What you know, which level is that? Is there a stronger punishment, or is it
against the law? I do not know what kind of punishment would be associated with this, but putting into statute. There's an assumption here, and maybe we have some other testimony, but it probably does become a misdemeanor. Class A, I think, was the staff's statement. I guess I would prefer to see this stay where the policy sits right now so that the agency could determine what violation actually occurred. I think this raises it to a higher level, and we would probably see a more difficult decision relative to legal or court action relative to this. And there's probably more subjective interpretation, I think, that would have to occur to narrow this down as to what violation actually occurred. And that's where I have problems with it, for sure. I'm just not sure what the impact is.
Harrison would like to add something here, if he had wants to point out here. Go ahead, Harrison.
Mr. Chair, members, I just thought we might, it's my understanding that what's happening is this language is being added to Chapter 496, and I believe that violations of wildlife laws in Chapter 496 are generally Class A misdemeanors. I see Joe Burley was shaking his head yes, but we have limited balls from the state police there to confirm that if necessary.
Can you follow up? Yes.
Members of Class A misdemeanor is up to 1 year and up to $5,000 fine.
It's up to those are the buckets trained cast off.
So does that go to court then?
Yes, that will take court action.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for allowing me to jump in. I would really like to see if this amendment seriously considers that we get some advice from some of our former judiciary members on that. How that would compare with other violations. I'd be reluctant to pass an amendment and put into statute. It seems to me that's not a light offense to be creating here.
Mr. Chair, I have several concerns about this as written. One is that, ironically, it may not even address the problem that the department had, in that the concept of personal gain may not be broad enough to address the points, because the points themselves, if one doesn't apply for future hunt, never result in any gain. And so we may have kind of a perverse effect in where this is so broad that it incorporates many, many gray areas, but doesn't address the problem at hand. And some of those gray areas would be that in the course of one's employment, one may become aware of information that is public information, but they may have come across that information because they are engaged with the department. And then you have this bizarre situation where an employee is breaking the law by learning public information through the course of their employment. And then we have a situation where an employee does something such as hears through fellow employees that there's a particularly large number of deer in a particular area slated for a hunt. Now, in this situation, the employee can choose that as his first hunting preference and may much more directly gain in that the odds of bagging a deer go way up. And that's very broad I think when it gets into a criminal statute and that it is too broad with these factors undefined in that type of gray area, I think it's entirely appropriate to have this group that the department is putting together wrestle with the design of the current system. I share Representative Cruz's doubts about whether the preference system made a heck of a lot of sense as long as a second choice is replaced by the first choice if the conflict is canceled. And I also think they could probably address it through the timing of people's applications so that applications made after essentially the probability of a hunt being canceled became common knowledge in the department that subsequent applications didn't gain that preference. There's lots of ways to address it, and I think it'd be incumbent upon this group to explore both changes within the department and whether more particular language addressing abuse of the system, the hunting tag system, are appropriate to bring back for legislative consideration. But at this moment, it means lots of problems and the possibility that we don't even solve the problem that led to this clause to begin with.
So we've run up against time that we need to adjourn for the day here. I want to continue on this. We'll probably schedule it as quickly as possible again here and finish our work on this bill. I know we want the rest of the bill here too, but and I also want to establish and kind of everyone think about this is that what we work to do here is to appropriately address the issue that's in discussion within the agency. That all of us that are tagged with being part of government are addressing this, and so in the eyes of our constituents, we have adequately addressed it and appropriately. So we gain back credibility as much as we can that which we lost. We want to build and enhance this department, not tear it down. And what and sometimes it does take a process of renewal, which is sometimes a restructure, and looks like tear down in the process, and sometimes it is, but what we want to do is make sure that we get back as much as possible in the direction of building credibility. You know? And I know how important it is, hunting and fishing or anything else to individuals, and being one myself and those within the department. I want those people to have the opportunity, not an advantage over my constituents, but have an opportunity because it means a lot to me. And I know how important it is. And so we'd want to take that away. So let's take a look at what we want to do here in statute here to address this. Because I think we can do something that will help. So let's all of us be thinking about that before we meet the next time. That's Nick Cruz.
Along those lines, Mr. Chair, I guess what the A4 amendment does, it adds the word non-employee of the State Department of Fish and Wildlife shall clearly the employee's personal gains in the use of information gained in the course of or by reason of the person's official position or activity. And I think anybody would be hard-pressed to disagree with that statement.
Mm-hmm. I think that's why they had that within their policy. Okay. All right. We'll be back at this again. Thank you, everyone. We'll get it posted. I'm not sure if we'll get it posted for tomorrow, if the president will, or it'll be on Friday. Okay? We adjourn for the day. Thank you.